It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Deadpool is coming out as a movie next week, which is amazing. It's something no one thought would happen. For years, it was trapped in development hell. But thanks mostly to the fans, we have it coming out next week with Ryan Reynolds, and it's a rated R movie. This created some controversy between fans who want to see a PG-13 movie that fits in with the rest of the X-Men, that younger kids can go to, and people that want a hardcore Deadpool that pulls no punches. I didn't know where to side, so I asked the creator of Deadpool himself, Fabian Nicieza. Fabian was fantastic. He was there on Deadpool's creation. He created the backstory. He did most of what you know of that character at a time when he was also directing most of the X-Men in the early 90s. If you're a millennial or if you were into the Fox animated series at the time, most of your memories of the X-Men were created by Fabian. It's a fantastic discussion, and we get into kind of what it was like to work at Marvel at that time, how he went in and added layers to Deadpool, and then we also talk about his time in the Batman offices, because we always have to talk about Batman.
Rob was planning on introducing three new characters in our first issue that he was going to be plotting and penciling, and I was going to be scripting. We had talked about, you know, a rough few issue breakdown for some of the ideas he had, but since it was really his first writing assignment, he was kind of plotting it as a way of laying out the book for the art. So a lot of the ideas were just the things he planned to do, but not specifically this issue is going to have this, this, and this, and these are the subplots. I mean, so it was a little looser at first. He knew a lot of the things he wanted to do, but Rob's a bit of an idea machine, so he usually had far more ideas than he could fit into a single 22-page issue. So I knew that we were going to have three new characters, and I knew that he wanted Deadpool to be a mercenary that can go toe-to-toe with Cable, but fight in a different way. Cable's like a tank, and he wanted you know, like a faster, sleeker, quicker character that could pose a threat to Cable that way. When I saw the rough pages, which were actually faxed layouts back then, faxed on my fax machine at home on one of those roller drum papers, if you remember those.
That's adorable.
That's how the pages came out for New Mutants 98, and he faxed them straight to my townhouse back then, not to the Marvel office, so that we could talk the issue through. I basically joked that it was obvious how much he loved Marv Wolfman and George Perez's Teen Titans, because Deadpool looked like exactly what Rob wanted him to look, which was an influence from Perez's Terminator Deathstroke character, but filtered through how much he loved what Todd McFarlane was doing with Spider-Man. And that, it was the gist of it. That was the totality of any kind of claim anyone wants to make, that the character is a parody of someone or that the character is a copy of someone, because it never was true and it's not true to this day. I'm the one who made the inside joke of calling him Wade Wilson. Mm-hmm. That wasn't anyone else but me having fun with the in-joke Rob and I were having about it. It wasn't anything other than that. It certainly wasn't meant to poke fun at anybody. It certainly wasn't meant to copy anybody. It was just me having fun with the idea that, well, this guy's such a good mercenary, then he's probably Slade Wilson's third cousin twice removed, you know? And that was the gist of it. I mean, claiming Deadpool's a copy of Terminator is as fair as claiming Terminator is a copy of Taskmaster. Mm-hmm. I don't think of them as copies of each other at all, because they're all incredibly different characters. In terms of their personality, in terms of the reasons why they do what they do, how they handle situations. Ultimately, that's what a character is. not necessarily just what a character looks like, much less what influences an artist may be drawing from when he designs a character. If you look at Deadpool, there's no doubt that there's Taskmaster and Deathstroke in that original design. That's because Rob loved George Perez, period. I love George Perez, too. You know, there, if you look at it, though, there's also a lot of Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man in there, too, because Rob loved what Todd was doing. Mm-hmm. And we've said this a gajillion times. I'm so tired of answering it, quite honestly. People are going to believe whatever they feel like believing. A lot of people want to believe the negative because they prefer to default to the negative when it comes to Rob or when it comes to early 90s comics. I'm too old, I'm too mature, and too different to care about the people who feel that way.
Well, in a way, it's a lot like Thanos and Darkseid, where, you know, Starlin clearly loved what Kirby was doing in the fourth world, but what was done with that character took it in a completely different direction.
And for the same token, you know, you can say that a lot of stuff in Star Wars and Darth Vader was copied from a lot of Kirby's fourth world stuff, too. It rarely is anyone stealing anything or anyone copying anything. 9 times out of 10, it's just creators being influenced by things they like and things they admire and things they enjoy and saying, I wish I could come up with something that's as cool as that. And that's how they try to work it.
Right. Now, was New Mutants 98, was that your introduction to the X-Offices?
Not really, no. I'd scripted an issue before that Louise was on vacation for, and they asked me to script it. I'd been doing some classic X-Men backups, so I was already working. I'd done an issue of Codenamed Spitfire for Bob Harris, the editor, before that for the New Universe books.
Right.
And I was Marvel's advertising manager at the time before shifting over to the editorial department, so I'd already been working at the company for 4 or 5 years before all of that even happened. So I had a relationship with everyone in the office on a company business level, and I was also selling my writing whenever I could to whatever editor was interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was trying to pace out that chronology, and that period of X-Men, when X-Men really hit that flashpoint of its peak popularity, it just seemed, even buying the books as they were coming out, everything was coming out so fast, and there was so much output, and you were at least 50% of that output, if not more. It was hard to kind of track where things began and where things ended. It was almost things just kind of exploded because, I mean, within 3 issues, New Mutants had become X-Force, and then.
Yes. Well, that there was also a 4 or 5 month gap between New Mutants 100 and X-Force number 1, I think, if I remember. And the plan to get us to X-Force number 1 was a long kind of a struggle internal in the offices to get Marvel to agree to cancel one of their top 10 selling books, especially a book that had just increased dramatically in sales when Rob took over as the plotter and the penciler, working to convince Marvel to do that was a challenge. And really, the only 3 people inside the offices that were saying this is a good idea to do was Rob, me, and the director of marketing at the time, Sven Larson, who was a huge advocate for relaunching the book as X-Force number 1. And ultimately, you know, it was Rob's entire idea for doing this and why he wanted to do it was proven 100% right, you know, because clearly the sales and the attention that the book got were infinitely greater than it was getting as just New Mutants.
So what finally swayed them in the argument? Was it a gradual wearing down, or do you remember a turn?
No, it was a little bit of a wearing down process. I think ultimately what swayed everyone is when it didn't become something on its own lost in the wilderness. We had to convince Bob Harris first, and that took a little bit, but not as much. Then we had to convince DeFalco, and we had to convince the sales department, we had to convince the publisher, the president of the company. Everyone had to get on board, and it was harder when we were just trying to do it with New Mutants and turning it into X-Force. What helped the process is when they decided to relaunch a new X-Men book with Chris and Jim, I think that turned it into the ability to have a summer event that would have pumped a tremendous amount of money into this, you know, the third quarter budget. So they saw that it's not, X-Force wouldn't be alone on its own doing this in June or whatever it was, that we would have X-Men number one coming out soon afterwards. So then it became the feeling that it was part of a plan and part of a larger line-wide thing, you know?
Right, and that's also around the time that Todd McFarlane was given the Spider-Man.
Yeah, I think Todd Spider-Man number one came out the year before that, though, didn't it? Or
it's 90. Yeah, so you're right. That might have been the first one.
Yeah, I think Todd's came out the year before, because I was doing the promotion on that stuff, and Todd's number one was part of a different group of books that were launching that time period. But even so, yes, clearly there was a little bit of precedent with Todd doing that. And at that time, anything Todd was doing, Jim and Rob wanted to do too. It's almost like you know,
including leaving and starting Image.
You know, if they get all the red M&Ms plucked out of their bowl, then we want all the red M&Ms plucked out of our bowls too. You know? So there was a lot of can you top this going on. Which is fun and healthy. In hindsight, it's absurdly immature. But at the time, it was really kind of fun and healthy for all the books and for all the creators to really kind of want to step up their game in terms of the way they were going to promote and market and sell the books.
Right. And that's really what created most of the boom in the 90s. It was both a combination of the Tim Burton Batman pushing a lot of readers back into comic stores, and then these number ones. Which it's funny to think today at a time when we're 5 years away from DC relaunching all their titles. We've had Marvel relaunch all their titles 3 times. There's rumors now that DC is going to do it again. But at the time, just adding these titles and relaunching New Mutants was an enormous, enormous deal.
Yeah, it was. But don't fail to take into account not just the Batman movie flowing into it, the rise of some more mature subject matter mainstream books in the mid to late 80s.
Oh, right, yeah.
Helped bring a slightly older audience, some of whom had more disposable income, so that they could afford to buy 5 copies of a comic thinking they were going to be worth something. Then the other side of that equation, though, is do not forget for 1 second that we had a pretty healthy newsstand market still at that time period.
Right,
and
right.
The cartoons that were airing, the Batman cartoon, the X-Men cartoon, the Spider-Man cartoon, all of those drove a lot of young readers into the comics business. And I know for a fact how much of our audience were younger readers that were brought into the comics as a result of having watched the cartoons. So we're talking about 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds. And you're not going to find that now. They're not there. Certainly not in the comic book shops. And we lost the newsstand, which was the primary way to get kids to sample comics, not comic shops. And all of that together is what led to that real surge and increase of sales. I mean, look, when I took over X-Men for Chris Claremont, I took over with issue 12, but we were selling on average about 700,000 copies a month of that comic book when I was doing it with Andy Kubert. It was not selling that much when Chris was doing it 5 years or 4 years earlier. Even when he had Jim Lee doing it or Mark Silvestri, it wasn't selling 700,000 copies a month. It was selling about 4 or 5, I think. Mm-hmm. So those numbers on all these books went up across the board for multiple reasons, not just the simple ones that people today want to look back on and think that defines a period. Oh, yeah, multiple covers, that's what did it. That's ridiculous. It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous argument then, and it's even more ridiculous now when you have the hindsight of being able to understand greater forces and influences on a marketplace.
Right, and we're at a time now where every book basically has a variant cover, and we're nowhere near the numbers.
Exactly. Well, yes, that's a good point, too. Not the least of which is because there's nowhere near the amount of outlets to purchase comic books that there used to be, and comic book prices have gotten away from the casual reader or the young reader being able to afford to get them.
Right. Yeah, and you know, as much as comic stores have evolved, and you find many more comic books that... comic book stores that are inviting to the casual shopper, it's still an effort. You know, it's still an adventure to go directly into that store.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not. You're right. And on the newsstand, back when there were newsstands, there were newsstands on corners at bus stops. You know, you would just see comics just walking down the street.
Yeah. No. And listen, we did it to ourselves as an industry. The fact that the profit margins were so much greater on direct market sales comics is what led the companies to focus more and more exclusively on the direct market and consolidate their sales for that. And ultimately, they had nothing to replace the newsstand that they were getting rid of, and they were foolish to think that comic book shops were going to replace those outlets. And it wasn't until the early aughts when trade paperback started to filter their way back into bookstores, and so many bookstores started having that you saw a rise in trade paperback sales that almost equaled the number of comic books being sold for the big two in terms of revenue generation. And it's not that much of a shock. Not only were older readers reading comics in a different way, they wanted 5-6 issues at a time now instead of monthly periodicals, but it was easier for a casual reader to go into a Barnes & Noble and find a trade paperback than it was for them to find a comic book shop and have to drive 20 miles to get to it, you know?
Right. Right. So going back to the initial appearance of Deadpool, did you see an impact right away from that issue and want to bring him back? Because I think X-Force 1 is the next time he comes back.
X-Force 2 is the next time he shows up again. And yes, we Rob wanted to bring him back because Rob liked drawing him, and he knew he wanted to do more stuff with him. The mail on that issue, we got like 5 times more mail than New Mutants usually got. The stack was, it went from a 6-inch stack to like a foot and a half, 2-foot tall stack of mail. And I know this because I read every single letter myself. And I would grab the mail from the mailroom before it got to Bob's office, and I would read the whole stack of mail.
It's great that you could measure it in actual feet.
And that back then, yeah, exactly. You can measure in actual feet because I got size 12 feet, so I could just put my shoes right up to The truth is that 75% of those letters said, "This guy's funny, bring him back. This guy's funny, bring him back." Everyone was saying that. So Rob and I knew we were going to bring him back because we enjoyed having him in the book and handling him. And he was fun for Rob to draw, and he's a breath of fresh air for me to write.
And what made you decide to make him a funny character? Because as you said, Rob was thinking of Deathstroke, who's very grim. And even Todd Spider-Man, the kineticism. What made you decide let's give him a sense of humor?
It was twofold. I know I had that Spider-Man in the back of my head, which to me means a jokester, a trickster, someone who, you know, flaunts authority, who's dismissive and rude to the villains he's fighting, as a way of demeaning them and keeping them off guard, you know, but also to mask his own insecurities. So that was in the back of my head. But the honest truth, apart from that, is that Deadpool appears for 7 pages in that first issue. It's like 6 in 1 panel, right?
Right.
And every character in that book was very stoic, very grim, very serious, very tough, very arrogant, very brooding. It was all the testosterone-y, pouchy things of the early 90s. And by the time I got to Deadpool's section of the book, I was tired of writing in that tone. So I wanted a change of pace. And a change of pace to me is a villain who is fighting a stoic, serious, dry character like Deadpool, or like Cable, I'm sorry, and someone who is the opposite of that while he's fighting him, which brings out more out of your main character if you do that, you know? So I wanted to make it easier, more fun, and a little bit of a breath of fresh air for me as a scripter. The fact that it clicked was fortuitous, but not surprising, because anytime you have Spider-Man go up against Cardboard Man, Spider-Man comes out funnier, you know? And Cable was Cardboard Man back then, you know?
Right.
And it works. So then the question becomes, this guy's a villain. This guy's been introduced as a villain. He's a mercenary. He's a killer for hire. And yet people like him because he's funny. He's got the same attitude and personality as Bugs Bunny does, but Bugs Bunny doesn't kill people.
Neither does Spider-Man.
Yeah, neither does Spider-Man, exactly. So as you watch his first appearances in that first year in New Mutants, you're watching the development of the character so that we can find our way around being able to, if not excuse what he does for a living for the sake of the personality we enjoy, at the very least explain why he is the way he is. So the whole thing about him not being him being masked is and being scarred underneath and all that stuff, that came later, and that came as Rob was actually starting to leave the book and I was starting to plan for what was going to happen next. And my mother-in-law was going through cancer at the time, and I was thinking, what would lead someone to do something that would cause them to become this way? And if he was desperately trying to fight an incurable cancer, that could explain how he could have become the way he became. And one of my regrets is that we never were able to just unmask him cleanly in that first year. That was not me. That was, and I don't think it was Rob. It was the editor who never wanted to reveal too much, which often led to not revealing enough. You know what I mean? So
it was kind of like a Doctor Doom approach back when
too much of that, but not even not necessarily. It's not the same thing exactly. Doctor Doom is masked because he was tragically scarred. Whether that was his whole face ravaged or whether that was one tiny scar and his ego wouldn't let him have that, that's open speculation for fans and for creators, right? That you were told right up front why Dr. Doom was masked. In his origin, you were told that. In his right. first appearance, you were told that. So the depth of the scarring is secondary to your understanding of why he is the way he is. So the Deadpool reveal was little bits and pieces, a torn mask here showing bulbous, scabby skin. You know, it just gets drawn out too long sometimes, and it certainly got drawn out too long back then by that editorial office. And as a writer, you want to plan things, and usually you plan them in an arc that flows smoothly, and that's usually like 6-month beats. To build, reveal, build off of what you reveal, twist from there. And you can see that ebb and flow every 6 months. The reason why the X-Books got a little crazy is because that ebb and flow was never allowed to be developed smoothly. So Deadpool should have been unmasked far more clearly, far more cleanly. It was something I wanted to do in his first limited series, and we still weren't allowed to. We still had to hint at it slowly and all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great segue to kind of how the X-Books ran. As I was saying at the beginning of our conversation, it felt like it was just this big world that was just kind of rolling, and you would advance the subplots a little bit each issue. And as you said, you wanted to kind of do 6-issue beats. Was it that you were writing these stories and being told to pace them out, or was it at X retreats that when you laid out all of these subplots, you realized you didn't have enough room for them in each issue? Basically, how were you able to plan a year and the multiple titles you were doing?
Well, you got to take into account that the multiple titles I was doing were for very different editors. So I could work one way with one editor and working a very different way with another editor. Hi, Natasha. Hi, Jesse.
Hi.
Sorry, my daughter just came home with her friend.
That's fine.
You're immortalized on a podcast.
As anything can be immortalized in a podcast.
So you could look at New Warriors issues 1 through 25, and you could look at X-Force issues 14 through 43 or whatever, and you can see very different plotting structures, okay? And that's because I was working for different editors who had different strengths and different weaknesses and different desires, and the X-Books became a little bit of a runaway monster that I don't feel was being well well handled, mm-hmm. because the editor and the other core writer both operated in a way that was diametrically opposed to the way I preferred to operate. So you would get a lot of disjointed subplots that were not allowed to follow through and climax, reach any kind of a smooth culmination. You had storylines that abruptly were discarded. You had mysteries that were never properly turned into sequential beats. Every two issues or every issue, you learn something new. So it was very different. And the insanity of that and the displeasure of that for me as a writer was tempered by my ability to write other stuff where that wasn't the case, where the opposite was the case. So I could feel very relaxed and very comfortable while writing those books, which made the discomfort I felt as a writer working on the X books more manageable. And the sad truth is that the bigger paychecks were coming from the X books. So although it wasn't as creatively fulfilling for me during that entire run, I was making more money doing it. So I had to keep doing it until I couldn't do it anymore, until they didn't want me to do it anymore. And it was a case of both for me, because I got fired off one book and I quit another book. You know what I mean? So it was just a matter of time that it wasn't going to work anymore. For me, it was how long, you know. I could actually milk it out longer if I wanted to, but I chose not to on X-Men.
Now, did you feel that way going in, or was it more of a cumulative effect?
It was a cumulative effect by far. I never expected necessarily that that was going to be the case. Mm-hmm. You know, it is what it is, and it was what it was. It was very difficult back then, because it is the epitome of, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Right.
You know, here you are working on the number one selling comics in the industry. You're writing two or three top 10 books a month. You're making more money than you thought you would ever make, but you're not creatively satisfied or fulfilled. So every month that book comes off the press and you look at it, and you're not happy with it. So that's difficult, and it was definitely very challenging for me to go through that. But like I said, another book could come off could come in our bundle, and I could crack it open, and right. and I could like the smell of it, you know.
Right. Was there like a final straw for you, or was it just more of a fatigue? As you said, you were fired off one book, but you quit another book at around the same time.
Roughly. No, I got fired off X-Force while Age of Apocalypse was going on. I didn't expect that, honestly. I thought I was going to get fired off X-Men and I would get to keep writing X-Force, which probably would have been my preference anyway. Mm. And so I wasn't ready for that. But the writing had to be on the wall, because I had just quit. I had quit Cable. Mm-hmm. They had rejected my second Deadpool limited series. Lock, Stock, and Barrel, they rejected it because they said it was too depressing. And I blew my stack, because I was really pissed about that, because they're telling me that they think they know better for a character they had given 2 seconds worth of thought to. Yeah. And I'd been racking my brains for months at that point, trying to make everything work for him.
Now, what did they find depressing? Were you going right for the cancer, or was there...
It was actually, the story was going to be his origin. The story was going to flash back to what happened to him at Department K, and what he had gone through in order to cure his cancer. The flashbacks were going to be told within the context of, in the present day, his cancer had come back. And he was furious because everything he went through and what he'd been turned into was made moot by the fact that the cancer would return. So he was going to track down the people that were part of the experiment that did this to him. So it was going to basically be his origin told within the context of a present day story where Frankenstein's monster is falling apart. Mm-hmm. And yes, it absolutely was depressing. No doubt about it. you know what, but so was Joe Kelly's Deadpool annual, where he told the origin of Deadpool, because the character's origin is tragic.
Right.
And you, for me, it was the most important thing to do with him next, after just having established in his first limited series that maybe, just maybe, he's not the biggest dick in the world. You know, he's half a dick. You know, that was the goal for the first miniseries, was to show that this guy is no hero, but he can have redeeming qualities to him. He saves Vanessa's life. He goes on a quest to find her and save her and help her and blah, blah, blah. He has supporting cast members. He has people that he's known for years. Why would they still work with him? It can't all just be because they're afraid for their lives, you know? So that was the introduction of Weasel, and that was trying to bring Courier into the book and doing all kinds of other stuff, you know? It was to set up the fact that this guy exists in the world, even though he is the way he is, you know? The second one was going to be, why is he the way he is? And having editorial tell you that they don't want you to tell the origin of the story, the origin story of the character you created, is really, really galling.
Yeah.
excuse me. Very,
well, not even to get revisions, just to have it outright rejected.
Yeah, and then to have it be what that second limited series was, and I stand second in line to no one in my respect for Mark Waid's work, but that was an editorially driven series where he's having a relationship with frickin' Siren, who's 15 years younger than him. It was just terrible.
Well, and Mark Waid didn't fare as that well in the X offices either.
No, well, to his credit, because Mark's got a lot more and personal pride than I do. You know?
Right. He'd also come to it at a different...
compared to me. He saw immediately what a ridiculous nightmare it was to work in that office, so he walked away.
Yeah. Yeah, he was also coming to it at a different point, where he had been at DC for a long time, and it was a big deal for Marvel to lure him over, and he figured, well, I could just go back to where he was. Whereas you were in the X offices, that you were getting started and immediately elevated. So I would imagine it would have been harder to walk away from that.
It was harder to walk away from it, not just because of the work and not just because of the money, but I had personal relationships in the office, and I worked there every single day with all of these people on a daily basis. We were all getting married at the same time and going to each other's weddings on a regular basis.
Now the Deadpool movie's coming out, so how are... I know you've been talking a lot about it on Facebook, but how much did you know about it going in? Did they loop you in as one of the original creators, or is this... I mean, it's not even Marvel Studios, it's Fox doing it.
Yeah, Fox. So I knew nothing about how he was going to be handled in the Wolverine Origins movie. I knew nothing about the script that had been written after that movie as a spinoff for the character. The script sat on a shelf for a while. I'd heard it was good. I heard good things about it from people who read it. But I never read it. And it was posted online at one point, too, and I never read it anyway. And when they greenlit the movie, it was good. I mean, I have zero involvement at all in the movie. I have liked everything I've seen them do from a marketing standpoint. I think it's been very well executed. The clips I've seen look good, but I am a very cautious person about this kind of stuff, because the reality is I'll know if I like it or not when the credits roll, you know, when it's over. I have to sit in a movie and actually watch it. I don't judge movies off of trailers and off of clips and off of what people say in interviews. I judge movies based on how I experience them when I watch them, you know? So I think it'll be good. I hope it'll be good. I've heard good things about it from people who've seen it already. I'm going to see it opening night, probably in New York, with a bunch of Marvel Deadpool people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds great. As I said, they've done a brilliant job, not only through the outright marketing of the trailers and the print ads, but the way they've used social marketing to just kind of get everyone's confidence up. And you know, Ryan Reynolds knows that there's love for this character, and this is a guy who was Green Lantern 5 years ago, and it didn't go well. So I feel like...
Yeah, but this character is far more up his alley as an actor and as his personality in Green Lantern is. And this production is really his baby. So I think that credit to him, if it's good and it does well, he deserves a lot of the credit because he's really, really been the one who spearheaded this. And I like him. I've always liked him as an actor. I really have. I think he's got a lot of personality and charm on screen. And I also thought he always had a little edge to him, too, which is perfect mm-hmm. for the character.
Right. But now, I saw you weigh in. There's been this controversy over the last week or so. I think just from people seeing how good they think the movie's going to be, is that they think it could be a bigger movie than something like Blade, which was an R-rated Marvel movie. So there's been all this controversy about should it be PG-13, should it be R? I know I have an 8-year-old that's incredibly angry that there's a Deadpool movie because he knows the character from appearing on Ultimate Spider-Man and there's action figures. And I know he's frustrated that he hasn't seen it, that he's not going to see it, really.
Yeah, he probably shouldn't either.
Probably shouldn't. I mean, I'll see it first and if I think he can see it, but I really don't see there's any way I think he can see this.
My feelings about it, and I've expressed them already publicly, is pretty simple. I disagree with anyone who says he has to be blank or blank. He has to be rated R, or he has to be PG-13. I disagree with that. I think the character has to be, for a film, for a feature film, the character has to be whatever the people who are making the movie, the studio that is paying for the movie and releasing the movie, determine they want it to be. Okay? So these creators clearly wanted to make it rated R. All right? That's not because Deadpool has to be rated R, because Deadpool has been rated PG or PG-13 for years, about 20 of them to be precise. And then in the last 5 years, artists in Marvel decided that it's okay to have entrails flying all over the page, which would automatically give you an R rating in a movie, okay? So Marvel produces borderline rated R movies, just for rated R comic books, just from the violence they show,
right?
All right? That's not because the character is rated R. It's because the artists and the editorial direction and the company direction have chosen that is something we can show on panel now, all right? You know he was slicing people's heads off 25 years ago, too. We just didn't show the flying heads across the panel because we weren't allowed to, mm-hmm. right? And I personally could care less about that kind of stuff. I'm a 54-year-old man. I don't get excited by gore, all right?
Yeah.
So I get excited by good story and good characterization and hopefully some funny lines, you know?
So if you had been allowed to in the 90s, chances are you wouldn't have even gone that way anyway.
I would have certainly gone a little more risque with the humor, but I probably wouldn't have bothered to go too risque with the violence. I wouldn't have minded showing red blood instead of black blood, which is what we had to do back then.
Right.
But I would not have had any interest whatsoever in showing a head flying across the panel or showing someone's intestines leaking out of their stomach. I find that all juvenile. I find it really stupid. That's my personal opinion. I have zero problems with the fans who do like it, and I have zero problems with the creators who want to draw that. So if the fan base of the character now wants that out of the character, I got no problem with that. We just did the digital comic with Riley, and there was blood spraying all over the place in some of those opening chapters, you know? And that's fine. It's not my preference, but if that's what the audience prefers, I am an entertainer. I'm not writing to entertain myself. I'm writing to entertain the person who is paying money to buy the product. So if they prefer that, I have no problem with putting some of that into it.
Right. Yeah, I find the whole argument strange anyway, because this is a film that, as you said, you haven't seen it, I haven't seen it, we haven't read the script, so I feel, and no one else has, I feel like we're in no position to say, well, you can make it PG-13 if you cut this and you cut this and you cut this.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no, listen, as far as I know, from what I've been told, there's no freaking way this could be PG-13.
Yeah.
Right? because PG-13 allows a certain level of violence, and that's okay because this is America and violence is okay. They don't allow gratuitous nudity and sex on screen. This movie has that. They don't allow more than one F-bomb in an entire movie, a two-hour movie. This Deadpool movie has, I believe, an F-bomb every 2 minutes. You know,
yeah.
So it's going to be what it's going to be. I turn it around the other way. I don't say what Deadpool should be or shouldn't be. I say, why are you doing this for this movie? Why do you want to start a petition to make a PG-13 Deadpool 2 weeks before the stupid movie comes out, which is ludicrous anyway?
Right, exactly. I think the time to make that decision is before shooting has begun.
Yes, exactly. Why aren't you also then doing a petition for a PG-13 Revenant? You know, I really would like to see Revenant with less bear claw tears on Leo DiCaprio. Okay, but I mean, it's just stupid. The studios are putting millions of dollars into this thing. They're determining what they consider their best business model opportunity to be. Some guy sitting at a computer in Idaho is going to say, you're leaving a lot of money on the table because you're not making a PG-13. Or some mom in Alabama who has no clue who Deadpool is going to say, I want my 8-year-old to be able to go see the PG-13 movie.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all... Look, it's just usual internet hot air. That's all it is. It's just hot air. The audience to go see this movie is primarily an 18 to 34-year-old male audience that wants to see this as an R-rated movie. So they are strategically making a business decision that we stand to gain more by appealing to this audience based on its release date, its budget, and what their expectations are for their business model, that they have a better chance to make money off of it as an R-rated movie than they would have as a PG-13 movie, because they don't want to alienate what they consider their core audience, which is 18 to 34-year-old arrested adolescent males.
Right. Yeah, and as you say, I think that's an excellent point, is they've obviously looked at this film and decided that an R-rated film will be profitable. And this is a film coming out in February. I don't know the entire numbers, but I'm sure it doesn't have the budget that X-Men Apocalypse has.
Not even close.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. People are very, very naive about this stuff because they don't understand the dollars and cents. The movie's budget is not the same as a summer release larger superhero picture budget. It is a much smaller budget. That's how they were able to make it the way they wanted to make it, which is as an R-rated movie, right?
Right.
So because it's a smaller budget and because it's coming out in February, it actually has less expectations on it and less impositions on it than a summer movie would have. I worry more about the sequel to Deadpool than I do about the first Deadpool, because the sequel will have more expectations and burdens placed on it by the studio than this current version, the first one, does, you know?
Right.
So the movie, here's going to be the next round. You're going to see this next, John. The movie's going to do well. The movie will make, let's say, $150 million U.S. and another $150 million or $120 million or whatever international. Right? That means it's going to make close to $300 million, and people are going to say it's a failure because it didn't make $1 billion like Age of Ultron did. Okay. That's going to be the next thing you see on the internet, and it's going to be people who have no understanding of the business of Hollywood and no understanding of the multiples of your budget you need to earn in order to be a success. So if Deadpool makes $300 million, based on its budget, it's actually more successful than Age of Ultron was based on its budget. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It is what it is. Once again, it's internet hot air, and I'm too old to pay attention to it. Really am.
But do you still feel a sense of ownership over the character, or as a work for hire, you've let it go but you still obviously have affection.
I try not to. I've been screwed over so many times with this character by editors that I kind of have forced myself to divorce myself a little bit from it. I wasn't allowed to do a second limited series when I wanted to.
It sounds like that was kind of your divorce, yeah, but right, look, there.
I resurrected the character from near death in the Cable Deadpool book, and I was rewarded by having one of the co-stars of the book taken out of the book he was which is, I just did a joke in the digital comic where I go, that joke never gets old. Joke never gets old. I had
it is kind of like that last season of X-Files.
yeah. It's like going to see Romeo and Juliet and Juliet's not in the play. So I had the character taken out of the book, and then the book got canceled, and they gave the two characters separate monthly books, of which I was not asked to write either one of them, even though I just saved both their asses from the scrap pile 4 years earlier by showing the company how to do the characters right. You know, so it is what it is. If I worry too much about it, it would drive me crazy, so I'd rather just not worry that much about it, you know?
Right. So, yeah, it seems like it's complex.
It is complex, at the very least. Indeed, yes. And listen, I don't read the books. I haven't read any of the books. I didn't read any of the 1990s monthly Deadpool book until after I'd already started Cable Deadpool. I was like 4 or 5 issues into it, and then I started to read some of Joe Kelly's run. Mm-hmm. Because I only had a few of the sporadic issues because I wasn't getting Marvel comps back then because I was already at Acclaim. I didn't read a single issue of Deadpool after Cable Deadpool was canceled for 6-7 years until Jordan asked me to contribute some stuff to the Wedding issue a couple years ago, or a year ago, and I wanted to catch up on it to get an idea of how Jerry and Brian were handling the character. So I asked them to send me some PDFs of the recent issues, so I read a few of those, just to get his voice through their mind, through their eyes, you know, so that I could be writing stories that were sounding right for the current audience reading the book. But they've been sending me PDFs of the most recent issues, and I haven't read any of them yet. It's a no-win situation to read that. But I'm pretty much the same way about any book that I've been fired from or I quit. You know, one of my best friends and my former assistant editor is Evan Skolnick. He took over New Warriors after I quit the book, and I didn't read his 2-year run for almost 10 years. And he was always asking me, did you read it yet? I go, no, not yet.
Give me another 2 years.
And I finally read it. And I'm not kidding. Like 10, 12, 14 years later, I finally read it. I go, hey, that was pretty good. You did there was some really good stuff there. And he's like, too little, too late.
Yeah. You know what? If you had come to me and said, you know that stuff you did when you were 26?
Yeah.
Like, I don't care.
Yeah. Well, there's that too. And the truth is if it's good, then I'm jealous and angry. And if it's bad, then I'm bitter and angry. So why bother being jealous or bitter when you just be angry?
Yeah. You're just always Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
But now, so with the new digital story, I find it really interesting that you research the character to catch up, to kind of get the tone of voice for the way where he was now and to fit the current series. So when you're writing the digital story, are you going back to your feelings of Deadpool, how he was in the 90s, or are you coming to him with a new approach?
Just to correct one thing you said, I wrote the character from 2004 to 2008, okay?
Right.
So my handling of the character is not based on a decade. It's based on my understanding of the character. Mm-hmm. So I didn't write him any differently in the digital comic, but what I needed to know is what's his status quo? What is his relationship with Shikla and how does he interact with Preston and Adsit and all this stuff? I need to know how the character is working in his current context. If Jerry and Brian were doing what I heard Daniel Way was doing with like narrative captions that was like schizophrenic mind conversations going on, mm-hmm. I would not have mirrored that or copied it just because it was what was happening in the books right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I don't agree with that. I don't think that's a good narrative technique, and I don't think it's the character either. So I wouldn't have done that. But I read Brian and Jerry's book, and Brian and Jerry's book is, you know, Deadpool. It's Wade Wilson. It's the character I created. So I was fine with it, you know? But it was more a matter of understanding and knowing what the character's current status quo is.
Okay. So, but when you approach him today, is it in your approach, is it the same as it was?
No, well, how I approached him in 2004 was where I shifted and changed.
Okay.
Because the last chance I got to write Deadpool might have been in Circle Chase number 4. I don't remember for sure, you know. But let's say it was 1994, 1995, right? And then I never read anything again with him until they asked me to start writing the book. Page 1 of issue 1 of Cable and Deadpool is the first time I'd written the character in 10 years, and it was completely off the cuff. It was like straight out of me. I just sat down at the typewriter and started to write the first scene of him by himself watching television, talking to the TV, getting angry that Bea Arthur isn't one of the sexiest women alive, and getting a phone call and needing to put on his mask to get into his Deadpool voice. You know what I mean? Which is no different than his Wade Wilson voice.
Yeah.
But that was not predicated on anything else that anyone else had written with the character for the 10 years prior to that, you know? So it was just me channeling the character again, but channeling him with 10 more years of experience and 10 more years of thought about what I would do with him differently, how I could handle him with an editor that actually might have a sense of humor. And understand humor, and understand that the character is Bugs Bunny by way of Frankenstein. Those are all things that the original editor of the book really didn't have a good grasp on. That they weren't things that they weren't the kind of things that were in his wheelhouse, you know.
Right.
And you know, Bob has a tremendous amount of strengths, but humor isn't one of them. Deadpool was always a bit of an odd character for him to get a handle on, you know? So getting to write him with a different editor, different sensibilities, in a team-up book, it was a very different experience.
Cool. Yeah, I can totally understand how it sounds like it's more matured than changed or shifted.
Yeah, I think so. I would say so, yeah. I mean, you get 10 years of experience and 10 years of you know, the back of your brain thinking about a character. It's inevitably going to make you approach him, you know, with just a more mature thought process behind it, which is ironic since, you know, it's an immature character.
Yeah, exactly.
And writing the character is very refreshing. It's very relaxing. For me, it's very enjoyable. It allows me to purge a lot of stuff that's in me and get paid to do it. Usually you have to pay someone to purge to them. But in this case, you get paid to actually, you know, purge all this garbage out of your system.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that readers are paying you to read this character. It's for the same reason. Well, this has been great. I so want to ask you about Batman because I'm obsessed with Batman. But I feel like we've done such a good job.
We're okay. I got a little time. Go.
I don't even have questions. I just
Batman. Any conversation about Batman is probably going to shift over to a conversation about like Robin and Dick Grayson and Tim Drake. But that's okay.
No, I'm fine with all of that. Well, you know when you but. Let's just discuss it from going from the X offices, which you detailed a lot in the 90s, to going to the Bat offices, which is at as big and as sprawling and as important for DC as the X-Men were in the 90s, what was the difference you felt stepping into yet another big section of one of the major comic universes?
Well, it was, first off, I'm working with Mike Martz, who's an editor I've known for, 20 years and who I respect tremendously. He's a great guy, and he's a really good editor in that he knows when to give you a rope and when to pull the rope tight, and the good thing was that the difference is when you're working in the X-Books and you're writing the lead book and writing two or three of the other satellite books, there's a tremendous amount of responsibility leading the creative way, right? With the Bat books, I didn't have to worry about that. I got brought in as basically Spackle Man, as Glue Man. I mean, Grant Morrison was the lead writer on the Bat books, deservedly so, and everyone else was following his story. Mm-hmm. And Grant is a genius, but like all geniuses, sometimes that's a little fractured. Mm-hmm. So as Glue Man, sometimes you got to follow the wake of the genius and make sure that some of these pieces are fitting properly in the other titles, because they always fit perfectly in his own title, but he's not a guy that thinks as much about how does this affect this story in Robin, or how does this affect that story in Oracle or Birds of Prey or whatever, So the stuff I did was really trying to put some pieces together with special projects like Bruce Wayne, The Road Home, and stuff like that. But it was a really exciting time to be in the books because a lot was happening. And that's always a fun time to be in a family of titles. When things are getting shaken up and the status quos are getting blown up, that's usually actually a really fun time to be a part of it all. So when I had the good fortune of being asked to take over for Chuck Dixon on Robin, which surprised me, and I was very sad and disappointed for Chuck, who's a writer I respect tremendously.
Yeah, we've had Chuck on the show a few times, and he's a great guy as well as one of my favorite Batman writers.
Yeah, Chuck's a really good writer, very underrated writer, and he's a good guy. And what he did with Tim Drake is given so little credence for writing over 100 issues of this character and turning him into the character he was. I can't say the character he is now because he got new 52'd, but the character he was.
Yeah, more than most.
Yeah, more than most. You're right. I stopped reading New 52 books about 2 years ago, so I wouldn't know.
I don't think they've done anything with him in the last 2 years, so you know.
Oh, really? That's good to know.
That first issue of Teen Titans, you know what happened to him.
Yeah, they really understand this character up there, don't they?
I think the big problem with Tim was once Grant introduced Damian, there was this feeling of where does Tim go now, and I feel like they never quite figured that out.
You know what? I disagree in that if he'd been allowed to continue going with Red Robin, Chris Yost wrote an excellent first year, and I wrote the second year, and I knew I could have written that book for another 10 years. I knew exactly where he was going. He is every college student who has to outgrow their childhood but is not yet an adult and is trying to find a way both to find his way in the world and find a way to reshape the world. Mm. And that's what all people that age try to do. And it's this wonderful dichotomy. It's this great push and pull of the soul, because you want so badly to fit in and be given responsibility and be validated. But for the same token, you also want so badly to change things and fix things and make things different than they are. And you always fall somewhere in the middle when you're in your 20s. So here's Tim becoming 18, 19, college age. It was a great opportunity to take him to the next step and let Damian be young Psycho Robin. That was fine. That was a nice new boots to fill. That was nice new shoes he was putting on. And Red Robin could have been something very different.
That's interesting, because I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. Since Tim is in the state of transition, he's not yet calcified the way Nightwing is.
Yes, very much so. In fact, with Dick being in his mid to late 20s, a lot of those illusions, a lot of those desires start to get chipped away at, and there's more this sense of almost domesticity. It's the marrying age, you know. It's the child rearing age. It's the mortgage age, you know. So not that these superheroes would be doing that, because every time you do that with them, you destroy them. But right. But philosophically and thematically, that's where you're getting to with Dick. And even when I got to write Dick Grayson for two issues in Nightwing, which was basically the thrill of my career to get to do that. It was a character that was between being young and carefree and understanding that he had very different responsibilities in the future. One of the best things that they did with Dick Grayson, but didn't handle it the right way, is when they transitioned him to being Batman, which I don't think he should have been, he started to take over and be the leader of the Justice League and all of that stuff. That's the next logical transition for Dick Grayson. That made sense, although I don't think he should have done it as Batman. I think he should have done it as Nightwing. You know, that's the transition for those characters. But you can't do that. DC's stuck. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. That's why they did New 52. The idea of doing New 52 is not a bad idea. It was the execution that was lacking. But if you look at the ages of these characters, they were starting to get into a really, really bad, cramped situation. When your teen sidekicks become as old as their mentors were when they became the heroes to begin with, and you now have newer, younger teen sidekicks, all of a sudden you're cramping everybody. You're starting the lower group is starting to push the middle group, and the middle group is starting to push the upper group. And what are you going to do with the upper group? You can't retire them. You can't say they're in their 30s and they got to quit being superheroes. So thematically, you start to lose the sense of what you want to do with them and why they exist. You know?
Yeah, and I think the only one they were able to do that successfully at that time was The Flash, because they had killed Barry.
Exactly, yes, very much so. Yeah. And they had a good writer writing the book.
Yeah, well, they had Mark Waid.
Yeah.
Well, this was fantastic, Fabian. Thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything else you want to let us know? What do you have coming up?
I am not doing any comic book writing at the moment. I'm working on intellectual property management work with a company in New York City, which I've been doing for 15 years, and we got like 4 contracts right now. So everything I've done for the last few months since the Deadpool Cable split second series, since I finished writing that, everything I've been doing has been focused on that. So we got a Hollywood contract. We got a contract with a university in Australia. We got a contract with a Christian mission in Canada. It's very interesting work, and very diverse work. And that's one reason I do it, is because it lets me put my fingers in completely different pies in the comic book world.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The last month has been spent working on a Hollywood intellectual property for a studio to help them forge and fashion that story world that they're going to need in order to create a movie based on this property. So no comics in the near future right now, because I'm doing all that.
Well, you're doing the good work.
Well, Thank you.
And how can we find you online?
Twitter is at Fabian Nicieza, and Facebook is Fabian Nicieza, and that's pretty much it, because I'm old and I don't want to do too many of these things.
Thanks again to Fabian for a great interview. If you want to follow me, I am at Not On My Book on Twitter. You can follow the show on Facebook, Caffeinated Comics. You can also listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can listen to the entire archive of our over 200 interviews on caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. We'll be back next week with a review of the Deadpool movie and keep this theme going. Talk to you then.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not On My Book production.
Take that, meatball!